Well, at the end of the service shortly, we'll sing one of the best known carols in the world. Charles Wesley's famous words of a hymn first published for Christmas Day in 1739 to music as we sing it by Felix Mendelssohn, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." It's a Christmas institution, a must sing for almost any carol service, which sounds out some breathtaking theology. And we're going to reflect on some of that theology in this little series over the next few Sunday mornings, and we begin today. And my title comes from the second verse. Don't let the familiarity, the domestication of Christmas, dull you to this staggering comment about Jesus from Charles Wesley. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. Don't breeze over that. Let it sink in. Chew on it. Because you'll never understand Christianity without getting hold of it, because it leads us to the most important question anybody can ever ask. Who is Jesus? Central fact of Christian faith is not a philosophy. It's about a person. And to take that person out of Christianity is a little bit like taking the numbers out of maths. It's like taking doctors out of medicine. It's like thinking of daylight without the sun. Take it away, and the whole thing unravels until there's nothing left worth bothering about. No, Wesley is spot on. Everything we are and believe as Christians depends on this one thing. We see and know and meet God in Jesus Christ, who is fully God and fully human, according to the New Testament, a doctrine that Christian people have for millennia called the Incarnation. See, you'll not find Christmas celebrations mentioned in the Bible, and yet the Christian meaning given to Christmas is the very foundation of the Bible. Charles Moore, the journalist writing last month in The Spectator, gently poked fun at an ad being run in the Financial Times by the church commissioners for a chief operating officer to manage their £5 billion portfolio. Six-figure salary, no mention, says Moore, of course, of anything Christian or ethical, but full of management speak. The individual who gets the job will have, quotes, a proven track record of driving continuous and consistent operational performances. And it goes on, the successful individual will have responsibility to build and maintain internal controls and a process and lead a no-surprise culture. It's hard to reconcile, commented Moore, slightly sarcastically, a no-surprise culture with the mystery of the Incarnation. Because surprises don't come any bigger than these breathtaking affirmations in John's prologue that the Word became flesh. Yes, we know this passage so well. We know these great cadences. We love them. But don't let that blind you to the shock, the incomprehensibility, the scandalous particularity, the historical incontrovertibility of these first Christian Christmas events. Think how this must have sounded to a first century Jew asking him or herself what they had made of the events of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, some of which they could just remember of themselves. For a people then or now who might just have begun to think that they could climb up to God through argument, through experience, through activity, through good works, if they could find him through speculation or spirituality or merit, God surprises us. And his name is Jesus. Think who's writing these words, first of all. John. The beloved disciple, the man who knew Jesus probably better than anybody else in the New Testament. And look where he begins. Matthew and Luke give us the historical detail. Yes, John's Christmas doesn't mention Mary or Joseph. It doesn't mention the inn or the shepherds or the stable or anything else. Matthew starts his story with Abraham. John goes further back still. Here in John is the story behind the scenes, the story that you wouldn't have seen if you'd been at the inn or on the hillside and heard the angels. This is the story you wouldn't know if you had merely stood in the manger and looked at the baby. No, this is something profound and powerful and unique in the whole of the New Testament. It's the reality of Christmas not seen historically, but theologically. As John answers the question, who is this child born in Bethlehem? And John, stretching our minds almost to breaking point, takes us to the very mind of God. He takes us into eternity. If you want to grasp who Jesus is, says John, you've got to go back to the beginning. Well, let me, in the moments I've got, show you just six things very quickly about John's portrait here of who this baby is. There's only time for the headlines. Here's the first. One, this is the Eternal One, verses 1 to 3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. What John's doing in these first three verses is telling us the most ultimate things he can about Jesus. Took him more than 3 years to figure out the fullness of who Jesus, his friend, was. He doesn't want us, his readers, to take more than three verses to get to the point. I'll stun you, says John. I'll blow you away with the true identity of this man who became flesh and dwelt among us. Why does John call Jesus the Word, Logos? It's a brilliant choice, for it held immediate resonances, not only for his Jewish, but also for his Greek listeners. A Jew would have recognized that in the beginning phrase straight away. It would have resonated back to Genesis in the beginning. They would have readily understood that the Word of God is the expression of the power and will and mind of God. The Hebrew Scriptures were full of a God who spoke. The Lord spoke. They would have known passages like that Proverbs 8 passage with its personification of divine wisdom. What God thought, how he acted, what he communicated. That's what Word would have meant to the average Hebrew person. If you want to see the Word of God, if you want to know the mind of God, if you want to see the creative power of God, if you want to see the Word which brought the very universe into its being, which displays the mind and purpose of God, then look, says John, it's here. It's in Jesus. But the Greeks, too, talked about logos in a physical sense. It was a phrase they loved to use. Here was the principle that held everything together in a world of change. They talked about it in a secular context. What kept the stars in their cosmos? What controlled the seasons? What brought order and purpose to the world? Well, Greek philosophers from Heraclitus to Plato and the Stoics spoke of that impersonal principle of meaning, that principle of cohesion, that rational principle that pervades all reality. They called that the logos, the life force. Plato had written wistfully, it may be that someday there will come forth from God a word, a logos, who will reveal all mysteries and make everything plain. And in a stroke of divine genius, John seizes on this word, logos, and he says, listen, you Greeks, the very thing that you most recognized, that you used in your philosophies and thought, and the thing you've written about for centuries, is here. And it's Jesus, come to earth. And we've seen him. And life can't make sense until you've connected with that, is John's message. Why? Because look who Jesus is in these first three verses. He's always been there. He did not have a beginning. He was not made. He's before time. Athanasius, one of the church fathers, put it, there never was when he was not. He's the creator. He's the organizing principle of the universe. He made everything. He's with God. He is God. This is who you meet in the gospel. That's the extraordinary thing. This is why we can't forget Jesus, because we're literally held together here this morning by him. That's why we don't fall apart. Something holds us together. That's from him. Can we take it in? And that's the extraordinary thing about Christian experience. It's nothing less than entering into something of that intimacy and fellowship that exists between Father and Son and has done infinitely in the Godhead. That's why Christianity is such an important and extraordinary privilege. Jesus is the eternal one, personality at the heart of everything. Second, Jesus is the revealed one, verses 4 and 5. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. All life originates in this word. That's obvious, for he is the creator of all things, as John has just told us. But here he's talking probably about spiritual life, primarily. There are two overwhelming problems that we humans face. We're spiritually dead, and therefore spiritually blind. And John says that Jesus is the remedy for both those problems. He has the life we need, and this life becomes the light we need. Think of the incarnation as a sort of window. Suppose you're in a room which is completely dark, without light getting in, and somebody knocks a hole in the wall and makes a window, and the light is let in, and the room is suddenly illuminated. But there's another side to it, because we're able to see the outside world through the window as well. A world which has always been there, but which we couldn't see properly before. And Jesus is a window into God. He's the light of God, who's come into the world to illuminate it, and who lets us see God in an entirely new way. And hundreds of us here could tell you of that experience of illumination, of lights going on, which Jesus brings. What Jesus did was open a window in time so that we could see the unchanging love of God for us. And that's an extraordinary thing. And if that's true, Jesus coming into the world, which reveals God to us, is the most important thing that has ever happened in history. He's the eternal one. He's the revealed one. Third, he's the promised one. Verses 6 to 8, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. And John the Baptist's task, as the last voice of the Old Testament era, is, verse 7, to testify concerning the light so that people may believe. He pointed to Jesus, the one who had been promised, the one to whom the whole of the Old Testament looked. And his job is to that extent like John the Apostle's. John, as you know, tells us at the end of his gospel, chapter 20, verse 31, that the reason he writes his gospel at all is that we may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing we may have life in his name. The whole of the Old Testament era had been anticipating this moment. Verse 17, the Apostle John reminds us that the word, there had been revelation through the law as well. The whole of the Old Testament had looked forward to this point, and grace and truth come through Jesus Christ. The Old Testament law and the sacrifices and everything else had been a shadow of this wonderful reality which was to come and which broke through in the birth of Jesus. And then in his life and death and resurrection. In Jesus, the promise of the Old Testament is fulfilled. He's the eternal one, the revealed one, the promised one. Then four, he's the rejected one. Do you see that? Let's not sanitize Christmas or domesticate John's masterpiece here. It's not all comfort and joy. There's incomprehension and rejection and darkness and denial and stopped ears and judgment. Christmas isn't about the living God coming to tell us everything's all right. John's gospel isn't about Jesus speaking the truth and everybody saying, of course, why didn't I realize that before? It's not like that. No, human response, I'm afraid, is more a case of, hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk to you again. Simon and Garfunkel's song from the 70s put it. Light, real light, true light, verse 9, has come. But verse 10, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. It's sad beyond description, isn't it? There is an inexplicable rejection of God's light. It's a frightening thing to say to your Maker and your light and your life, I don't know you. I don't receive you. I hope there's no one here who'll say that lightly this Christmas. Fifth, he's the saving one. Because the other possible human response is there in the next couple of verses, 12 and 13. To all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. See, Christians believe that Jesus Christ is the closest encounter with God to be had in this life. God makes himself available for our acceptance or our rejection in the person of Jesus. It's what we do about him, ultimately, that determines the people we are and the direction we're going. To have encountered Jesus is to have encountered God. That's the message of John's prologue. That's Wesley's point in the carol. It's John's message here as he gets to perhaps his most staggering assertion of all in verse 14. Here's John's take on the Christmas story. Do you see it? Who came into the world? The Eternal One, the Revealed One, the Promised One, the Rejected One, the Saving One, and sixthly and finally, the Glorious One. Verse 14, the Word became flesh and lived for a time among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father full of grace and truth. Pre-existent Word came to be flesh, human being, God con carne. And when he came to be flesh, he didn't give up anything of what he was. And having taken on humanity, he will never, ever again set that aside. And do you see what he did? Verse 14. He lived, dwelt among us. Literally in Greek, set up a tent. See, if I move into a community and build a palace with high walls and electric gates and cameras around the perimeter, it says something about my desire to be with people, doesn't it? But if you pitch your tent in my back garden, you'll probably find yourself using my bathroom and coming into my kitchen and warming yourself by my fire on the cold nights. You'll be looking for quite a lot of interaction, I suspect, with me, if you pitch your tent in my back garden. And that's a little bit how it is with the incarnation. This is why God becomes human. He comes to pitch a tent in the human backyard because he wants quite a lot of contact. And suddenly in that moment, heaven and earth are joined as God had always intended. And you know, he didn't send a subordinate. He came himself. And that's the wonder of the incarnation. And here comes the personal testimony of John the Apostle, verse 14. What do we see when we look at Jesus, the man? What did John see over those 3 years of contact? He saw glory. And what do you see when you see glory? You see God himself. God the Son, full of grace and truth. See, nobody ever needs to be in the dark about God again. It's gone beyond parchment and paper or video or Skype. This is live. God has pitched his tent in our backyard and said, "Observe me in action." And when you watch Jesus in action, you watch God in action. And when you hear Jesus teach or speak, you hear God teach. And when you come to know what Jesus is like, you know what God is like. As the late Archbishop Michael Ramsay liked to put it, God is Christ-like, and in him is no un-Christ-likeness at all. And that's what John's saying. God put on flesh in what we call the incarnation. That force that unleashed a million stars, that power that set the planets in motion, that immensity that hand-carved every atom in existence and set them spinning, all of that was contained in a real flesh and blood human body that got tired and tempted and hungry, that wept and bled and died. You may know the story of Father Joseph Damien. He was a 19th century Belgian Roman Catholic who worked in the Pacific with leprosy sufferers, and he worked tirelessly for 16 years, immersed in the needs of his people, until one Sunday morning he shocked his congregation rigid by having as the opening words of his sermon, "We lepers." He'd contracted the disease himself, and he died 18 months later. When Jesus speaks now, he says, "We humans," because he has taken on our humanity to rescue us and restore us and remake us and rejuvenate us. That's the wonder of the gospel. And who of us would dare say we understand this? T.S. Eliot speaks of the incarnation as the hint half guessed, the gift half understood. And of course he's right. But we understand enough, don't we, to know that this Jesus has claims on us, that he deserves our worship. See, it's all wildly improbable, except that it happened in history, in Palestine, when heaven placed her most precious being in a human uterus, and the omnipotent became breakable and chose to be dependent on the nourishment of a young Jewish mother. And that baby born in Bethlehem is none other than the living God come to declare himself to us, to pitch his tent in the back garden of humanity so that we can have a lot of interaction. And when that happens, the eternal enters time. The all-powerful makes himself vulnerable. The unknowable becomes knowable. The invisible becomes visible. The unreachable becomes embraceable. And God is never again a stranger to the believing heart. Well, that's John's take on the Christmas story. The Word speaks to all of us today. So let's not patronize him or sentimentalize him. Above all, let's not reject him, but let's bow in worship and gratitude as we sing this last great carol together.